I next met with Dr. Ramesh Ramanathan from the Mayo Clinic in Phoenix, Arizona, and to begin, he commented on some of the subtle differences between the ASCO and NCCN guidelines for management of metastatic pancreatic cancer.
The ASCO guidelines are very helpful. It's important to keep in mind they're different from the NCCN guidelines. The ASCO guidelines are based on randomized data, which is Category 1 recommendation. So they are much more stringent than the NCCN and ESMO guidelines. So when in practice, it's helpful to have both the NCCN and ASCO guidelines for practitioners to look at. I think they're essentially the same when you look at first-line choices and second-line choices. They are almost the same. The NCCN gives you more real-world options and more scenarios, so that certainly is helpful. So I think that's the main difference between the two.
Okay, great. So I wanted to ask you, you were a part of a paper in the British Journal of Cancer a few months ago, Clinical Study of Genomic Drivers in Pancreatic Ductal Adenocarcinoma. Would you want to talk about that?
That's a paper our group worked on and published, looking at samples in clinical trials from patients with pancreatic cancer, both who underwent surgery as well as metastatic disease. So there were some interesting findings. We found that tumors from patients with metastatic disease have much more genomic aberrations than patients who had surgically resected tumors. So I think that goes to show as cancer progresses, becomes metastatic, there are more abnormal genes and more aberrations. We did find a number of aberrations, mutations, which can be used to guide therapy. And we are interested in this concept of what we call BRCA-type signature. A lot of people are working on that. We think perhaps up to 20 to 30% of patients have tumors which are more sensitive to cisplatin, not necessarily have a BRCA mutation, but a BRCA-type signature. And I think that's important. It may be the group that also responds to FOLFIRINOX, because FOLFIRINOX has oxaliplatin and also irinotecan, which is somewhat similar to cisplatin.
It's interesting you bring up the BRCA, because I noticed that one of your patients had a, we'll get into that later, I noticed that had a relative or sister with BRCA mutation. You mentioned BRCA-like abnormalities. What about PARP inhibitors?
Yes, so PARP inhibitors would be an option in these patients. Again, PARP inhibitors are not approved for pancreatic cancer. It's approved for other tumor types. So there's a lot of interest in using PARP inhibitors as maintenance or in combination with cisplatin, irinotecan, or even MM398. So there are clinical studies which are ongoing.
What about BRCA germline mutations? I know there are cases of BRCA germline mutations. What do we know about PARP inhibitors in those patients, and platinum for that matter?
So there is preliminary data that patients who have germline BRCA mutations who develop pancreatic cancer, in a retrospective study, patients treated with a cisplatin regimen seem to do better than those who are not treated with cisplatin. Again, this is preliminary. So in my practice, we would incorporate cisplatin at some point for these patients. Again, all this is still very recent and more data is being generated. It's interesting that patients who have a germline BRCA mutation may not always have a somatic mutation. You may not see the mutation in the tumor. We have seen a few cases.
Wow, how does that happen?
The BRCA mutation is not the cause of the pancreatic cancer in those patients. They may be heavy smokers. Again, these are anecdotal cases.
I never thought about that. So you're saying that if somebody has a BRCA-related, let's say pancreatic cancer, they'll have BRCA in the tumor, but if they have a sporadic cancer and happen to have BRCA germline, it won't be in the tumor?
So it can go both ways. So you can have a BRCA somatic mutation and not have a germline mutation. And these are very uncommon cases. Patients have a germline mutation and we're not seeing the BRCA mutation in the tumor. So in those cases, it wasn't the germline BRCA mutation that caused the cancer. And usually have been heavy smokers where pancreatic cancer developed irrespective of the BRCA mutation. So I think in pancreatic cancer, a lot more work needs to be done. I think this is unlike breast cancer and ovarian cancer, where I think almost always if you have a germline mutation, that's the cause of the cancer.
Oh, that's interesting. What about MSI-high-related pancreatic cancers? Do they occur? And a checkpoint inhibitor has been used.
They do occur. In the New England Journal paper, which evaluated pembrolizumab in MSI-high tumors, there were a couple of pancreatic cancers. So interestingly, early-stage pancreatic cancer the incidence of microsatellite instability seems to be higher than metastatic disease, exactly what we see in colon cancer. So it's certainly worth checking, but unfortunately, in practice, it's probably about 1%.
Somebody, I can't remember who it was on the faculty of the meeting we did Saturday, said, I think every single patient with metastatic cancer of any type should have MSI testing. Agree or disagree?
Yeah, I agree, because that's approved for any solid tumor with MSI high. And these days we get multiplex genomic panels, so MSI is now included in most of the commercial tests.
Maybe that could be a little bit of an introduction into the issue of immunotherapy in pancreatic cancer. I know you had a review article on that, Therapeutic Advances in Gastroenterology, and I see that you actually, I guess, at ASCO GI had a poster on an ongoing trial that you're doing with nivolumab, nab-paclitaxel, cisplatinum, and GEM. So can you kind of talk a little bit about what we know about immunotherapy in pancreatic cancer and also about your study?
Immunotherapy in pancreatic cancer, unfortunately, we are not seeing single-agent activity compared to other cancers like lung, melanoma, and bladder cancer. So there have been a couple of studies published, and response rate has been disappointing as a single agent, except in the cases where the tumors have microsatellite instability. So I think we need to take a different approach. Preclinical studies suggest that you need a second agent to disrupt the stroma, increase T-cell trafficking into the stroma, and that can be done in a number of different ways. One is chemotherapy, one is radiation, vaccines, co-stimulatory molecules. So there are a number of ways you can increase the effectiveness of checkpoint inhibitors. So one of the studies that I'm involved in with Dan Van Hoff, Akut Borsansi, is evaluating chemotherapy, the gemcitabine nab-paclitaxel backbone, also with vitamin D calcitriol. And these in preclinical studies have shown that they disrupt the stroma, allow T cells to infiltrate and increase neoantigen shedding and immunogenicity. So this is a pilot study in combination with nivolumab.
You know, of course, NAB-GEM is a common regimen that's used in pancreatic cancer already, but there is the issue of the fact that you don't need corticosteroid pre-medication with nab-paclitaxel. How much of a benefit is that?
I think that's a concern. I think when you give cytotoxic chemotherapy, generally you need to give steroids as part of the anti-emetic regimen. I think that's something we need to study carefully. With GEM nab-paclitaxel, you can get away without steroids as part of your anti-emetic regimen. So that may be a strategy for the first dose, not to use steroids, but to use your other anti-emetic cocktails. If the patient has nausea or vomiting, then you would need to add the lowest dose of steroids possible.
Yeah, you know, this issue comes up also when you talk about using corticosteroids for autoimmune toxicities with checkpoint inhibitors. And, you know, kind of everybody says, well, it doesn't seem to have any negative effect. But theoretically, does the amount of corticosteroids you use, for example, use paclitaxel, do you think theoretically that would affect the immune response?
I think so. I think when you have immune checkpoint inhibitor toxicities, we treat that with steroids, so that abrogates the side effects and presume efficacy. Again, in the single checkpoint inhibitor studies, when patients are retreated, they seem to regain the efficacy after that episode of side effects wears off. So I think in practice, it's best to use, if you have to use corticosteroids for symptom management, to use the lowest dose needed.
So this trial that you're doing, it's a phase two single-arm study? Nivolumab, NAB, cisplatin, and GEM.
Yes, that's an ongoing study. That's a phase two single-arm pilot study.
What have you seen so far in terms of tolerability and efficacy?
The study is ongoing, and there certainly has been activity. The tolerability is something we are carefully evaluating because these drugs certainly can cause side effects, especially when used in combination. So up to now, it's been monitored closely and side effects have been manageable. I think my colleagues, Dr. Borsansi, will be submitting an abstract to the ASCO GI meeting.
And I guess the thing everybody wants to know, particularly if you're going to combine it with chemo, is are you seeing any prolonged, you know, disease control? But is it too early to, or do you have patients out 2-3 years?
I think it's too early to get a handle on the efficacy. We are seeing quite a degree of activity. It's very encouraging. The goal would be we see prolonged responses to what we see in melanoma and other cancers. I think that's much too early. We should get more mature results by the time of ASCO GI.
So you mentioned the issue of the stroma with pancreatic cancer, and I was curious, there's this agent, PEG-PH20. There was an oral data set presented at ASCO. Could you talk about what you understand about this agent and sort of how it works and whether there's any reason to think that, you know, maybe it's going to end up in practice?
So PEG-PH20 is a pegylated hyaluronidase, and hyaluronidase breaks down tissues. And in pancreatic cancer, as we know, stroma is very important. We think the stroma in the pancreatic tumor acts as a barrier to chemotherapeutic agents, prevents T cells from entering, and perhaps that's one of the main issues that pancreatic cancer doesn't respond well to chemotherapy. This agent, which is pegylated hyaluronidase, has very good preclinical data to use this in clinical trials. The preclinical studies done in KRAS mutated mice by very well-known investigators have shown remarkable activity in mice, that tumors shrank considerably and remained that way for quite a long period of time when combined with gemcitabine. So based on these clinical data, clinical trials have been started. There is one study initially with gemcitabine and then gem-nab-paclitaxel, a randomized phase 2 study, and that was presented at ASCO. So that study did show encouraging activity, especially in the 40 to 50% of tumors which have high hyaluronin levels. It's a targeted drug aimed at tumors which have high hyaluronin. And high hyaluronin, it's a marker of poor outcome. I think the story is very similar to HER2-new in breast cancer. HER2-new by itself is a bad prognostic sign, but it also is a marker of activity for trastuzumab. So that study is ongoing. At the same time, we have had conflicting data from a SWOG study that I'm part of, using PEG-PH20 with FOLFIRINOX, a randomized phase 2. That study was halted on review by the Data Monitoring Safety Board because there was no added benefit to PEG-PH20. So we are trying to figure out why we have differences. I think this is a very important question because we have two studies with differing outcomes. In the study with FOLFIRINOX, it's a different backbone. The amount of PEG-PH20 given is less in the first 4 weeks because we could not escalate further. PEG-PH20 does seem to increase side effects of chemotherapy with FOLFIRINOX. So there are a number of differences and a lot of ongoing activity in trying to figure out why we have these differing results.
Your analogy to HER2-positive breast cancer is really interesting. Even the whole idea of targeted therapy of pancreatic cancer is kind of interesting. But I think if I'm remembering correctly, wasn't this agent associated with some kind of clotting problem?
Yes. PEG-PH20, when given with chemotherapy, whether it's FOLFIRINOX or gem-nab-paclitaxel, increases thromboembolic events. So in both the clinical trials, patients needed prophylactic low molecular weight heparin, and that reduced the thromboembolic event. So that also is very interesting, and I think there's something very important there because this was not seen in the phase 1 study as a single agent. So it's clearly some interaction with chemotherapy or some other process. I think PEG-PH20 is clearly an active drug and does interfere or modulate the stroma. And it may be that the chemotherapy backbone is important. I think that we are finding that out.
You've had a number of papers that I thought were really interesting in terms of the topic of chemotherapy of pancreatic cancer. One I thought was interesting in the journal Pancreas, tumor reduction in primary and metastatic pancreatic cancer lesions with nab-paclitaxel and GEM. I thought it was interesting what you did in that study. Can you talk about that?
We were very interested in that because I think oncologists and radiologists always felt for the last 20 years that the primary pancreatic mass does not shrink in response to chemotherapy. So we wanted to look at that. The MPACT study, which randomized patients to gemcitabine or gemcitabine and nab-paclitaxel, that was a registration study, 841 patients. Prior to that, we did a pilot study of gemcitabine and nab-paclitaxel, and about 2/3 of patients had primary pancreatic tumors. And we had a debate whether the RECIST criteria should include the primary tumor because we thought that wouldn't shrink. And much to our surprise, we did PET scans in that study. It was very PET-heavy. Vast majority of pancreatic cancers are strongly PET-heavy. That was also a surprise. And the primary pancreatic cancer shrank. So when we went back and looked at the phase 3 study, the rate of reduction in size was almost identical to metastatic lesions, so, which also leads us to preoperative therapy, because I think that is the basis why we increasingly use preoperative therapy, because you can reduce the size of the pancreatic tumor by chemotherapy.
So actually, now that I think about it, I guess the reason maybe people thought the primaries wouldn't shrink was, you know, the dense stroma. But do you see that dense stroma in metastatic lesions?
Yes. So
really?
Yes, we see that because my colleagues published a paper where they looked at tumor samples from metastatic lesions as well as the primary, and the percentage of stroma in the metastatic lesions was same as primary pancreatic
cancer.
Wow,
really? That is fascinating.
Yeah, so I think that's another important observation from all these studies, that there is stroma in the metastatic lesion as well.
Wow. I'm going to ask that as a poll question at one of our meetings. I bet you nobody's going to know that.
It's been published. My colleagues published in Clinical Cancer Research.
Or maybe everybody knows that except me, but I don't know. So it's you know, histologically, you look at it, right?
Right. Wow, no, it's not a well-known fact.
Wow.
I think people
debate
this question.
That's a really good one. Anyhow, so yeah, it kind of sounds like, I guess that's sort of the way it evolved with colon cancer. Initially, when people started, I guess, using chemotherapy and people who presented with metastatic disease, they didn't know what to do about the primary, and they saw that it usually responded if the mets responded.
Yes, I think colon cancer, exactly the same thing. When a patient presents with non-obstructing primary cancer and metastatic lesions, these days we'll treat with chemotherapy, and we see good responses in the primary there as well.
I'm going to ask you about a poster that you all had at ASCO looking at a nomogram you developed for predicting survival in patients treated with NAB-GEM in the IMPACT study. But also, just to take a step back, because we were talking about the stroma, and now you mentioned this thing about the stroma metastatic disease. You've done a lot of work, obviously, with nab-paclitaxel, particularly with GEM and pancreatic. Do you think there's something pharmacologically about it that creates an advantage? You know, I remember they used to talk about SPARC and all this other stuff. You work with Dan Van Hoff. At this point, do you think there's a different biology or pharmacology to NAB, let's say, compared to, you know, regular paclitaxel?
I think so. I've been part of studies previously with docetaxel and paclitaxel with gemcitabine. We never saw this kind of response, 40 to 50% response. And these responses happen very quickly. So I think nab-paclitaxel is different. So the mechanism of action, it's difficult to pinpoint just one mechanism. I think PARC is still important. That's been shown in other studies. So SPARC is a protein expressed on pancreatic cancer, and liposomal drugs like nab-paclitaxel attracted towards SPARC and are taken up by the tumor. In the phase 3 study, SPARC overexpression did not predict for response. So I still think it's important. I think the SPARC assay can be refined, so that's still ongoing work. But nab-paclitaxel also is taken up by macrophages, which are seen in pancreatic cancers, in the stroma. That's one mechanism, and that's also important for other liposomal nanoparticle drugs like NALIRI or MM398. And these nab-paclitaxel in preclinical models also has been shown to degrade the stroma, increase delivery of gemcitabine. So there are multiple mechanisms why nab-paclitaxel with gemcitabine may have improved effect. It also interferes with gemcitabine metabolism, increases active drug. So multiple mechanisms, I think.
So getting back to this poster that you presented with this nomogram and also your general clinical experience, you know, sort of taking a step back in terms of the science of it, but more from the point of view of the doc in practice. So I guess my question to you is, based on this work that you did, as well as your own experience, when you're about to start somebody on NAB-GEM, whether neoadjuvant or metastatic disease, you know, in a good performance status, well, just say if you're going to start it, first of all, globally, in your mind, what do you think the chances the patient's going to benefit, you know, clinically? You know, from your point of view, you really feel like something happened that helped the patient. And is there anything, you know, I see you looked at all these factors that you looked at. Some of them were kind of interesting, neutrophil to lymphocyte ratio. But from a practical point of view, is there anything to look at, you know, performance status that'll help you sort of shade that prediction a little bit?
We were interested in looking at the survival of different groups in a clinical trial. When you look at phase 3 pancreatic cancer studies for metastatic disease, it's striking that there's almost a 20% mortality in the first 3 to 4 months after patients enter a clinical trial. That's not really seen in breast cancer or any other tumor type. Almost always, 30% of patients, unfortunately, have rapid progressive disease. They don't respond, and they pass away in the first 3 to 4 months. So you see a rapid drop-off.
And this is, and you think about it, these are people who are going into trials.
Right.
So they're probably considerably better shape than the average patient.
Exactly. So these people meet eligibility criteria, and the investigator is confident that they have a six-month survival, but they don't make it past 3 months. And we see this in practice when you look at Medicare and SEER data, 30% of all metastatic pancreatic cancer patients never get chemotherapy or never even see an oncologist because their performance status declines rapidly, that they go straight to hospice. So we were interested in looking at some simple criteria. The normogram does predict, it's not perfect, but there are three groups, poor, intermediate, and good prognosis. Because on the other hand, we do see patients now make it past 18 months and 2 years, so there's a group, and it's difficult to predict from the very beginning. I think in practice, performance status is obviously still number one. ECOG, we know that somebody with ECOG 3 who's bedbound, doesn't leave the house, unfortunately has a few months survival. So the way I pick a regimen in practice is age and performance status primarily. CA19-9 baseline level is somebody who has a CA19-9 level of more than 5,000 or even 1,000, but 5,000 or more in a recent study was shown to be, unfortunately, a very poor prognostic factor. Those patients don't tend to do well. So, but primarily, it's age and performance status. In my practice, patients under 65, performance status of 0 or 1, I generally go with FOLFIRINOX. Unless I have a clinical trial, I'm certainly comfortable randomizing all patients to GEM, nab-paclitaxel, plus or minus a new agent. So younger patients in our practice get FOLFIRINOX, whether it's preoperative or metastatic disease. So I think it breaks down to 20 to 30% in our practice would get FOLFIRINOX, 50 to 60% will get GEM, nab-paclitaxel. Increasingly, very few patients get single-agent gemcitabine. I think it's safe to give GEM, nab-paclitaxel, perhaps at a reduced dose or even a every two-week regimen. So single-agent gemcitabine, unfortunately, doesn't do much. Increasingly, we don't use it.
I saw that you were part of the so-called SENA-1 study. There's a poster from ASCO GI. It was an interesting concept of gem-nab followed by sequential modified FOLFIRINOX or modified FOLFIRI. What happened with that?
We wanted to look at sequencing, something similar to what we do in colon cancer. So in this study, patients were treated with GEM nab-paclitaxel up to 6 months or till progression, and then at that point sequenced to modified FOLFIRINOX, so if they had neuropathy, FOLFIRI. We had 35 patients. Two-thirds of patients were able to go on to FOLFIRINOX. That was a surprise. This is a very intensive regimen. Median survival was about 16 months. We are writing the paper as we speak, and a high response rate.
That sounds pretty good.
It looks pretty good. I would not recommend doing this in practice. It is a very intensive regimen. When you look at the cumulative toxicity over a year, 40% or so have grade 3 fatigue. So it's tough to get through. In practice, I would favor, after GEM, nab-paclitaxel, using NALIRI, 5-FU and NALIRI. I think that's a much more tolerable regimen. You don't have the issue of neuropathy. I think it can be done. I think it's a useful benchmark, but in practice, I would do things a little differently.
Has there been any thought to this sort of sequential strategy using, say, NAB-GEN followed by NALIRI?
Yes, in that particular study, we had a separate cohort where we treated with GEM nab-paclitaxel for 2 cycles, followed by FOLFIRI for 2 cycles, because that did away with the issue of neuropathy. It was much more tolerable. We had a few patients who had toxicities, primarily stents, but when those patients are excluded, this alternate regimen was actually pretty well tolerated. We did not use NALIRI in that study. At that time, it was not approved, but we are looking into a sequencing strategy with 5-FU, NALIRI, alternating with GEM, nab-paclitaxel.
That's interesting. You know, I wonder, too, has anybody thought about the idea? I mean, it's kind of similar, but God, I was thinking sort of about like lung cancer, the way they do maintenance treatment. So, you know, like NAB-GEM followed by NALIRI maintenance.
Correct. I think as chemotherapy evolves, we have more effective regimens. We have to start thinking about a maintenance strategy in metastatic pancreatic cancer because these regimens, FOLFIRINOX especially, it's very hard to push this past 4 months. Fatigue, neurotoxicity, anemia, dust buildup. So we are looking into clinical trial designs where we give chemotherapy for 4 months. Also with gemcitabine-paclitaxel, the median time there on treatment with gemcitabine-paclitaxel is about 4 to 5 months. And then just like colon cancer, I think we are closely paralleling colon cancer therapy, where after maybe 4 or 5 months of intensive therapy, we want to go to a maintenance strategy and also introduce new drugs in that situation, whether it's a PARP inhibitor or another targeted agent.
The reason I was thinking about lung cancer, because you think back, you know, like maybe 5 years ago in lung cancer, one of the thinking there was that to use some kind of maintenance because a lot of patients weren't living to get second line therapy. And the idea is to bring it in kind of as maintenance. And, you know, when you think about the prognosis of pancreatic cancer, you wonder whether that kind of a strategy in a research platform would make sense.
It has to be an effective maintenance regimen. In pancreatic cancer, as you said, we really can't give people treatment breaks for long, unlike colon or breast cancer. If you give a treatment break, the cancer comes back, grows back pretty quickly, and becomes more resistant. So in maintenance in this situation, it would be, for example, if it's gem nab-paclitaxel for 4 months, it would mean gem and another agent, or maybe an oral agent based on preclinical data, which is much more tolerable, no neurotoxicity. But I think you had to introduce another agent as maintenance.
Right. You were talking before about the issue of platinum agents in pancreatic cancer. And I see that at ASCO GI, again, you had a poster on a pilot study looking at NAB-GEM with cisplatin. Can you talk about that? And also whether there are any predictors of benefit, you know, genomic predictors to platinums?
That study showed very encouraging response rates. Again, this is done by my colleagues, Gail Jameson and Erkut Borosansi. This is a pilot study where gemcitabine, nab-paclitaxel, and cisplatin is given on a day 1H schedule, repeated every 21 days. Pilot study, about 25 patients, response rates in excess of 60%, median survival, 16 months. And interestingly, responses were very rapid. In the first 4 weeks, patients had a dramatic decrease in CA19-9 levels. 2 patients had a complete response. So we think this is an effective regimen. The doses have been modified to make it easier to give in day-to-day practice. There's a group of patients who respond very rapidly to this regimen. It may be 30 to 40% of these patients have a BRCA type signature. My colleagues have tumor samples and it's being analyzed right now. We are looking at DNA damage mechanisms as well as genetic markers which may predispose to this regimen. A similar study was done by MD Anderson, Dr. Schroff, as well as us in bile duct cancer. And very similar results seen, very encouraging responses. Median survival of almost 18 plus months in bile duct cancer, where prognosis is usually very poor. So we have broad experience now in more than one tumor type. A lot of interest in moving this to a phase 3 setting.
And you know, we just did a seminar on ovarian cancer, and he's thinking about their strategy of using PARP maintenance after platinum response. So I wonder, you know, in these patients that you're talking about, these kind of somatic changes, you give the NAB-GEM cis and maybe look at PARP inhibitors as maintenance?
Yeah, exactly. I think that's a strategy we are looking at, whether it's a PARP inhibitor with gemcitabine or 5-FU as maintenance, because those patients who respond are probably telling us that there's a BRCA type signature there even without testing.
We were talking about NALIRI, and I want to ask you about a paper I saw that you just were involved with there. But first, I want to ask you about an abstract that you all submitted to ASCO, second-line treatment in patients with pancreatic ductal adenocarcinoma, a meta-analysis.
Correct. So that was a meta-analysis done by our group, Dr. Tony Saab and other colleagues, looked at second-line trials with oxaliplatin backbone, irinotecan, or NALIRI. And the meta-analysis showed that NALIRI or irinotecan-containing regimen was better in combination with 5-FU as second line compared to typically 5-FU oxaliplatin or FOLFOX. So I think in practice, NALIRI with 5-FU would be my preferred regimen as second line therapy after gem-nab-paclitaxel. There's also a question whether FOLFIRI is equivalent. I don't think so. Again, the story is very similar to nab-paclitaxel and taxanes. In pancreatic cancer, the nanoparticle formulations seem to be much more active than their counterparts.
That's interesting. You know, I was telling you that I was working with Tony Saab at the CME meeting, And it's our year in review where we review all the big papers of the year. So we're talking about pancreatic cancer, and he says, oh, there's this meta-analysis. And everybody goes, what? What kind of meta-analysis? And he told us about the data that you just described, and we were like, wow, that is really interesting. You know, we know when we survey investigators and we say, what's your second-line therapy after Gem-Nab? They say, Nalira, E5FU. But, you know, when I saw this meta-analysis data, I mean, it looks kind of convincing in terms of what you just said.
Right.
So it's evidence-based.
Right, that's evidence-based. Well, for Nalira, we have a randomized phase 3 study accepted by the FDA. So I think I'm a little conservative in my treatment choices. I tend to go with published data. And Nalira with 5-FU is FDA-approved regimen for second line.
Yeah, certainly a lot of people do that. What about your paper in Clinical Cancer Research, correlation between furomoxetol uptake in tumor lesions by MRI and response to nanoliposomal arena TCAN?
Right, so that was an interesting study that we did. Well, we wanted to evaluate Nalira in patients with solid tumors to see if there is increased uptake in tumors and whether we could find a biomarker. Furomoxetol, as you know, is a iron replacement agent, and that's taken up by macrophages, and observation was made in the past where patients got furomoxetol for iron deficiency and then got an MRI for some reason and tumors lit up with furomoxetol. So it can be used as a contrast agent. And interestingly, in mice, tumors which have a high content of macrophages, this is typically pancreatic cancer, stroma, macrophages, show up much better on an MRI, so it can be used as a contrast agent. So we did a trial, small pilot study, which was a very intensive study. Patients got furomoxetol as an MRI contrast agent. We did 3 serial MRIs. Patients had 3 serial biopsies before and after drug administration. It took a huge amount of work, and I'm really proud of my colleagues who were able to complete this.
You did 3 biopsies?
Yeah, 3 biopsies. And patients obviously volunteered for this. So.
Wow. And were these generally mets or primary or both?
The patients to go on study needed to have liver metastasis, and they needed to have 2 liver metastasis more than 2 centimeters so you could safely biopsy them.
So they were liver biopsies?
They were liver biopsies. Yep.
Wow.
Yeah, so it was very, very intensive study. But I think it provided very valuable information. So furomoxetol, MRI, tumors which had a higher uptake of furomoxetol on the MRI tends to be more active when treated with MM398 or Nalira. So in other words, this could be used as a radiological biomarker. And in fact, this is being used in a number of other clinical trials as a potential radiological biomarker. Biopsies also showed that tumor uptake of Nalira or SN38 was about 5 times more than what you would expect when given with just irinotecan.
Wow, that is really interesting. I'm not sure I remember hearing that being documented like that. Are there other studies that are similar to what you just described? Because everybody talks about this theoretical advantage of the liposome, but has that been shown, the actual, I guess, increased uptake?
This is the only clinical study which showed that. This has been shown in mice, but this is the only clinical study which actually showed that you get up to 5 times or more of SN38 into tumors with Nalira.
So this, I guess, imaging method to predict treatment benefit, do you think that theoretically it could actually be used to determine whether or not to use Nalira? If you see it, what's the chance of benefit? If you don't see it, what's the chance of benefit?
Right. So this was a small pilot study. I think we had 12 or 14 patients. So interestingly, tumors in the same patient have different characteristics. We saw patients with multiple liver metastases, some which took up furomoxetol, some did, and had differing responses. In the same patient, tumors with high furomoxetol content were more likely to shrink than those without.
Wow.
So we think it's a good biomarker, but certainly has to be validated. And we are looking at strategies in pancreatic cancer, gastric cancer, and these have actually started. And breast cancer, there is an ongoing study in breast cancer. Patients are not selected based on this, but this is a secondary endpoint to see which tumors shrink when treated with Nalira based on the furomoxetol MRI.
Who's the breast cancer investigator that you're working with?
It's Dr. Jaskit Sachdev. She's leading this study. And if I just can go back to the furomoxetol MRI, So we looked at different time points of doing the MRI. It looks like you give the ferumoxytol, allow 24 hours for uptake, and do the MRI 24 hours later. That seems to be pretty good enough to look at uptake.
And theoretically, because you mentioned breast cancer and other cancers, but what kinds of systemic therapy do you think would be more likely to be correlated, or any kind of systemic therapy?
We think this is for any nanoparticle or liposomal agent, any encapsulated agent, because this is preferentially taken up by macrophages.
Huh. Let's try to go through some of your cases. And maybe we can briefly talk about what happened and then what you think is kind of the teaching point of the case. So let's start out with your 63-year-old lady with obstructive jaundice.
I think this is a fairly typical scenario that you see in practice. Patients present with obstructive jaundice on high-quality imaging. A teaching point is you really need to get a pancreatic protocol CT to look at the blood vessels. I think MRI seems to be equally good, but I think the gold standard is pancreatic protocol CT. That means the contrast has to be given rapidly, bolus contrast, to look at the blood vessels.
So do you think most people know that? Pancreatic protocol CT?
Apparently not. Outside of surgeons, it's still very disconcerting. Almost always when we see a case from the community, we had to repeat CAT scan.
Wow.
Patients come with contrast CT, but it's not pancreatic protocol specific. It's almost like a CT angiogram where to put two IVs and give contrast, rapid bolus. We see patients who look like they are resectable, then we do a pancreatic protocol CT and we see a blood vessel abutment.
Wow.
So that's an important teaching point.
Wow, that is interesting. That's another one I'm going to ask on a poll question, see if people know about.
Right, absolutely.
I can never tell if it's me or, or not, but I never heard of that.
Yeah.
Okay, so
again, obstructive jaundice. If you're looking at doing preoperative therapy, should not put in a plastic stent. They will get clogged, especially with FOLFIRINOX. A short metal stent these days is fine for surgery. Surgeons are able to deal with a short metal stent, can remove it at surgery.
Again, is that routine or do people not always do that?
That's not routine. Usually patients will come with a plastic stent, which has to be changed in 3 months. And then depending on the timing of surgery, if it's going to be prolonged treatment, the gastroenterologist will put a short metal stent. You should not put in a long metal stent, then the surgeons will be very upset. So that's an important point. So if it's borderline resectable based on abutment, in our practice, any abutment of arteries, we consider it borderline resectable because getting a clear margin when there's arterial involvement is difficult. So unless it's clearly resectable, our practice is to do neoadjuvant therapy. And the regimen we pick is based on age and performance status. Just like metastatic disease, younger patients, ECOG 0, 1 would get FOLFIRINOX. That's about 20% of our patient population. Rest would get GEM, nab-paclitaxel.
Let me ask you, what are your thoughts about the idea of doing neoadjuvant therapy on patients that appear to be resectable?
I think that's a clinical trial question. I don't recommend it when I see a patient in for a second opinion. If it's clearly resectable, and especially if the CA-19-9 is less than 100, 180, I think those patients outside of a clinical trial should go to surgery. We do have a clinical trial for potentially resectable, so we preferentially would put those patients on a clinical trial, chemotherapy followed by SBRT. But otherwise, unless there are factors, especially if the CA-19-9 is 500 and it looks potentially resectable, that indicates a bad outcome. So in that case, we may give preoperative therapy, but otherwise should go to surgery.
You said you have a protocol looking at chemotherapy followed by SBRT. That's interesting. Has that been done before?
That has been done before. There have been single institution pilot studies with chemotherapy and SBRT, but SBRT really requires expertise and only done at selected institutions because I think it requires a lot of expertise and planning, radiation oncology planning, because you are giving high doses of radiation over a short period of time, which can lead to side effects.
I mean, obviously SBRT is used a lot in community-based practice in the brain, et cetera. You think it's a different story with the pancreas?
Correct. With the pancreas, if it's not done properly, you can get tremendous side effects, usually duodenal ulceration and bleeding.
Wow.
Because the bowel duodenum is right behind in a pancreatic head tumor.
Huh.
And there have been cases of, you know, exsanguinating bleeding.
Wow.
So with newer techniques and experience, it's become much safer. But I think outside of a highly experienced center, this should not be done in community practice.
I mean, it kind of sounds intuitively like a good idea.
Correct.
So, okay, so this patient got FOLFIRINOX, modified FOLFIRINOX.
Correct. Patient got modified FOLFIRINOX after three cycles, had a good response. And this is where a multidisciplinary board really needs to evaluate the case. So in our practice, we would give chemotherapy till the surgeon feels confident that this is resectable. So it may be 2 to 4 months of chemotherapy. We don't usually go more than 4 months of preoperative chemotherapy. If the tumor doesn't shrink by then, it's not likely to do so, and we would switch strategies. So after the first staging CT scan, if there is sufficient shrinkage, the surgeon is confident of getting negative margins, the patient would go to surgery. If not, we would give another three cycles, reevaluate. If there's still a question of a positive margin, at that point, we would incorporate radiation therapy. We don't do radiation for all cases of preoperative therapy. That's why you really need to have an expert team, a radiation oncologist, a surgeon, and a medical oncologist reviewing these cases every couple of weeks.
So what happened with this patient? Did she go to surgery?
This patient went to surgery. We did not give radiation in this patient because it looked clearly resectable, very nice response. We didn't want to add 6 weeks of radiation and delay surgery. So the patient went to surgery and had a margin negative procedure, T3, N1, I think. She recovered from surgery, and now the question is adjuvant therapy.
Is that where she's at right now?
Yes, she's on adjuvant therapy. And in her case, we are just giving gemcitabine with capecitabine as adjuvant therapy standard practice.
But, I mean, that sounds like a pretty good outcome. How's she doing on the gem capecitabine?
She's about a year out and doing fine.
Oh, so she finished it?
This is a case from about a year and a half ago.
How do you approach dosing with the gem capecitabine, and how did she do in terms of tolerability?
The gem capecitabine study, that was the UK study, used capecitabine for 3 weeks. It was 3 weeks on, 1 week off, not the 2 weeks on, 1 week off that we are used to. In the majority of our patients, we find this difficult. I think this is what has been seen in the US. Capecitabine doses, which are used in the rest of the world, are not well tolerated. This patient needed dose reductions, and we did go to a 2 week on, 2 week off schedule because of hand foot syndrome and diarrhea. And with dose reductions, she completed an additional 3 months of treatment.
I'm sure you have a lot of experience with that regimen. So right now, how do you usually approach dosing? Do you generally end up dose reducing people, or do you start low and dose escalate up?
In adjuvant therapy, I don't tend to use lower doses than what has been published. I think you're looking at an extra few percentage points of perhaps cure. So that's my usual way of treating patients. Also, similar to adjuvant colon cancer, I use the bolus 5-FU and then dose reduce if patients can't tolerate.
So let's go on and talk about your 74-year-old man.
Yes. So the second case is a patient with metastatic pancreatic cancer. Typical presentation, multiple liver metastases, good performance status of ECOG 1. So the options in this patient, obviously a clinical trial. We have clinical trials, and that's always our first priority. In the absence of a clinical trial, in this patient, I picked gem/nab-paclitaxel just because of his age. 74, I'm a little nervous about giving FOLFIRINOX. And this patient did well, had a response, but started to develop grade 2 neuropathy and early signs of progression. The CA19-9 started to go up. And at that point, he needed a change. I generally do not wait for patients to develop grade 3 neuropathy. I think that's a bad strategy. You either have to dose reduce or change when patients have persistent grade 2 neuropathy. That really does affect quality of life. So this patient was changed to NALIRI and did well and still on treatment. Decrease in CA19-9, decrease in tumor size. And is actually tolerating this well.
What's going on with the neuropathy? And from your point of view, is the NALIRI inducing any side effects?
This patient, little bit of diarrhea, which is being treated just with Imodium. We have not had to dose reduce. The neuropathy has basically resolved. It's less than mild tingling numbness, grade 1 or less. So I think it would be possible to reintroduce gem/nab-paclitaxel because the patient did not progress by RECIST criteria when we switched treatment.
So he wasn't progressing. You just switched because of the neuropathy?
Switched because of the neuropathy and a rising CA19.
Rising CA, right. I see. What's your experience globally in terms of the clinical activity in NALIRI that you've observed and also in terms of tolerability issues? This patient seems like he did pretty well. And what do we know about how NALIRI might compare to, say, FOLFIRI?
So that's a question a lot of community oncologists ask. Can I use FOLFIRI instead of NALIRI? I think it depends on the situation. When you treat patients with FOLFIRINOX, there are times because of neuropathy or extreme cold sensitivity, fatigue, I drop the oxaliplatin, and in that situation, I just continue with FOLFIRI. But when you look at second-line therapy, I think the published data for efficacy is with NALIRI. And as we talked earlier, based on preclinical and pilot studies looking at tumor biopsies, NALIRI shows a better outcome. So as second-line therapy, I would use NALIRI with 5-FU. Till we have more data, there's a SWOG study using second-line FOLFIRI. After GEMNAP paclitaxel, I don't think FOLFIRI is a suitable regimen.
So I want to ask you about the other two cases that you have, but just a couple other things I've been thinking about as we talked about. First, it seems like I've seen trials that are ongoing now moving NALIRI up earlier as part of initial therapy. Can you talk about that strategy? What's being looked at?
There are a couple of strategies being looked at. One is sort of a FOLFIRINOX regimen with NALIRI, 5-FU, and oxaliplatin. That's an ongoing study in which I am participating. It's a dose escalation study to see what's the optimum doses of NALIRI and oxaliplatin in combination with 5-FU, and that's comparing that to GEM-NAB-paclitaxel. So that study is ongoing. We don't have any data yet, but hopefully we'll have some data by the next year. I think that's the frontline study moving it up that I know of.
Just a couple of general questions I was thinking about as we were talking here today, and then we'll finish out with your other cases. But I was just thinking, when you were talking about that subset of patients with pancreatic cancer who, you know, go downhill so quickly, I was thinking about some of the research, particularly I've seen it in lung cancer, but I think other cancers too, on the issue of early palliative care. So the idea of having people start to get followed by palliative care specialists, even if, you know, they're doing well, but bringing in the palliative care person early. Any thoughts about that? And is that something you do at your center?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's very important to involve palliative care early on. As you mentioned, there's a lung cancer study which randomized patients to early versus just supportive care, and patients who got early palliative care actually live longer. I think oncologists are very busy. We tend not to have much more time to focus on very detailed supportive care and symptom management. And pancreatic cancer patients, in contrast to other tumor types, have a lot of symptoms which are difficult to manage. Weight loss, early satiety, nausea. And pain is not easily controlled just with narcotics. You may need a nerve block, a celiac plexus block, adjunct medications. So we involve palliative care for almost all patients. There is sometimes the patient who's totally asymptomatic, they would probably benefit, but you know, constraints on capacity, those patients, palliative care may not be necessary. But I would say for 80% of not only metastatic, even locally advanced patients, any pancreatic cancer patients would benefit from early palliative care.
You mentioned the weight loss, and I'm curious, any sort of clinical pearls you have or clinical experiences you have with weight loss or any of the other palliative issues with pancreatic cancer you want to pass along?
I think weight loss is very common. Patients present with anywhere from 30 to 60 pound weight loss at time of diagnosis. There are things which can be improved. It's still undertreated. Pancreatic insufficiency is undertreated with enzymes. Patients may not have the typical stools floating, the commode, abdominal cramping after eating. They may not have the typical signs, but a lot have pancreatic insufficiency. So involving a dietitian, early pancreatic enzymes are very helpful. We may not be able to reverse the total weight loss, but you can at least stabilize and improve quality of life.
Could I just ask you, that's an interesting thought. Do you like do fecal fats or how do you?
I don't. It's mostly clinical signs and symptoms. We do increasingly involve our gastroenterology colleagues where they do more formal testing. I think that's important, but as oncologists, we have not concentrated on this part. I think it's a very important part, and involving a gastroenterologist early would be helpful because a lot of times we just treat on an empiric basis.
That's a really interesting thought. Any other sort of palliative pearls?
Yeah, I think for the weight loss, patients can have bacterial overgrowth where stasis, gastroparesis, gastric outlet obstruction should not be forgotten. It's very common with a tumor in the head of the pancreas, and we attribute this to nausea induced by chemotherapy, but they actually have a gastric outlet obstruction.
Wow, interesting.
Where you can put in a stent, and these days surgeons can do a laparoscopic gastrojejunostomy just 2 days in the hospital, and patients feel much improved. So palliative surgery, even in the metastatic disease setting, should be considered. That's why you really need to have a good multidisciplinary aggressive team.
Any pharmacologic support? Do corticosteroids help in your experience?
Yes. Corticosteroids help. Regulin or prochlorperazine, I think that's the generic. Simple pharmacologic measures can help. Just doing some small things can have a big effect on the patient.
Well, you know, I was just reading a study out of the University of Washington where Washington has legalized marijuana. And Florida, where we are, it just became legalized. And they found a lot of interest in their patients in that. And actually, I think overall, like globally, 25% of the patients were using it. Is that of any value to patients? Have you had any experience with that?
Yes. State of Arizona, medical marijuana is legalized. So our patients are increasingly making use of that. There are some patients who certainly benefit. It is a little bit concerning that we really don't have good studies or good follow-up. I think that's critically needed. A lot of academic centers do not get involved in this, prescribing medical marijuana. It's sent to a medical marijuana clinic, so we really don't know what patients are getting and how they respond to this. So I think having formal studies is helpful because some patients do benefit, not everyone, but it seems like the younger patients benefit more than older patients who are also on multiple other medications with causing maybe drug-drug interaction.
So let's finish out with your last two patients, who are really interesting cases. This 74-year-old woman who looks like she had a potentially resectable met, huh?
Yes. So this is, I think, an important subset of pancreatic cancer. We don't think of metastasectomy in these patients, but increasingly there's small series and anecdotal reports that patients with limited metastatic disease may benefit from metastasectomy. But one scenario where I think this really benefits is patients after surgery present, especially with lung metastasis. And lung metastasis from pancreatic cancer usually indicates a more indolent disease. And I have had a handful of patients where, just like this patient, we have done lung metastasectomies or SBRT, and this has gone on for a few years. It may not be curative. Another lung metastasis may show up a year later, and we keep resecting, just like colon cancer, unless there is widespread disease where you go to chemotherapy.
So this lung met showed up 3 years after her initial surgery. Did she go to surgery?
Yes, she went to surgery, and now disease-free a year later. Most of my patients like this, once you have a lung met, it does tend to come back. There's a handful of patients where this may be curative, but I think you can stretch this out, increase life expectancy and disease-free survival by very careful patient selection for metastasectomy.
Any fantasies about what's going on in these unusual patients? Do you think this is all about the immune system?
There's obviously something different about these patients, whether it's the immune system or the genomic signature. I don't think we know yet. These are patients where we collect the tumor samples, where we are analyzing some of them. We have a number of cases where these unusual long-term sort of survivors, we have serial tumor samples from the first surgery to metastasectomy, and about 5 of these patients are undergoing genomic analysis right now.
I'm trying to remember where pancreatic cancer stands in terms of mutational burden. High mutation?
No, surprisingly, everybody would think this is high mutation burden, but surprisingly, mutation burden is low compared to other tumors. But it is different, even though it's a low mutation burden. It's KRAS is uniformly seen. KRAS is mutated, but it's a whole spectrum of different mutations. No two pancreatic cancer patients look similar when you look at the genes. It's sort of disordered genes.
Really? So in other words, I mean, like breast cancer, you have like 4 or 5 subtypes. I've seen that with colon, I think. But pancreas doesn't work that way?
Well, a recent paper did put these patients into 4 or 5 subtypes. But again, it's not as clean as breast or lung cancer. I think there's still overlap. And these are artificial criteria, and we don't know how they would respond prognostic or predictive fashion.
So let's hear about your last patient. I was hoping you had somebody who had a BRCA germline mutation, and here it is.
Yeah, so increasingly we see young patients with a family history. the incidence of BRCA mutation is probably in an unselected population 5%, less than 10%, but it's an important subset because it's unknown to the patient and family before that.
Are you saying 5 to 10% of patients with pancreatic cancer have BRCA germline mutations?
I would say more likely 5%. There was a study done from Toronto where the first 300 patients who walked into the clinic, they just did BRCA testing and found about a 4% incidence in unselected patients.
I mean, that's a lot.
That's a lot.
I mean, that's the same exactly. as ALK in lung cancer, 4%.
Correct.
I mean, it's in the ballpark, you know?
Yeah.
Interesting.
And importantly, in that study from Canada, 2/3 of patients did not meet the criteria for BRCA testing, the clinical criteria. So you would have missed if you're not checked.
Wow.
So in our practice, virtually any patient under 60, we test for BRCA, PALB2, a multiplex panel.
Wow. Is that in any guidelines?
Not yet, but I think will be soon.
I mean, because I just kind of realized by asking people on prostate cancer that the investigators there, castrate-resistant metastatic prostate, BRCA testing, germline, regardless of family history. And you're saying metastatic pancreas, or all pancreas should get BRCA germline?
Not all patients. I think we need more criteria on which patient to select. But generally, in our practice, less than 60, if the patient is interested, even without a family history, we would check.
So anyhow, this 51-year-old man or woman?
Yes. So this patient has a strong family history, and this was a patient I saw recently. None of them had been checked for BRCA mutation. So we talked to the patient, and she's going to undergo testing, but she has pancreatic cancer. We are treating her, we're considering her that she would have a BRCA mutation, very likely to have one.
The write-up you have says the patient has a BRCA2 germline mutation. Is that correct, or we don't know yet?
Well, that was the case that I added in, but she has not been tested
okay,
yet.
Okay,
so
she's going to be tested. So if she turns out to have a BRCA germline mutation, would that change the way you think about her management?
In this patient, with or without a BRCA mutation, I'm treating her with FOLFIRINOX while waiting for the results to come back. We didn't have a clinical trial for this patient. I think GEM, nab-paclitaxel, or gemcitabine cisplatin in particular is certainly an alternative regimen. I think these patients respond well to FOLFIRINOX as well because it has irinotecan and a platinum. Oxaliplatin may not be the same as cisplatin in BRCA mutated cancers. So I'm pretty comfortable treating her with FOLFIRINOX. I may use cisplatin or a PARP inhibitor later on.
It's interesting, though, you mentioned the idea that maybe oxali is not as effective as cis. And I'd be curious about your thoughts about carbo, incidentally. But are there actually data to support that?
No clinical data yet.
This is in BRCA germline.
In BRCA germline, I'm not aware of clinical data that oxaliplatin or carboplatin is not as effective as cisplatin. That's a question why I've asked my laboratory colleagues. We want to do some preclinical studies because this is an important question. And increasingly, there's data that oxaliplatin may not even be a platinum drug. So,
oxali?
The mechanism.
Hold on.
It's a platinum derivative, but the mechanism of action is very different from cisplatin. There's some preclinical studies, and there are a number of investigational platinum analogs, and the mechanism of action is very different from cisplatin.
What about carbo?
Carbo seems more closely related to cisplatin than oxaliplatin. So I think carboplatin certainly is a reasonable option in these patients because of impaired kidney function or age. But I think with the platinum agents, just in the last few years, there are a number of new nanoparticle platinum agents, platinum analogs, and when you look at the preclinical data, it's very different from cisplatin in the way they have the effects on the cancer cell.
That's really fascinating. I remember when oxali actually came into practice a long time ago, and I know you were really involved with that, but it's interesting what you're saying about the mechanism. What do we know about people who get treated with, you know, one after the other? So you have somebody get oxali, they progress, you give them cis, what happens?
There are some just anecdotal studies in pancreatic cancer patients treated with oxali did not respond, and then they responded to cisplatin, especially if they have a BRCA mutation. So again, very preliminary anecdotal data. But in this patient with the BRCA mutation, I would use cisplatin at some point.